Welcome to Transmission Podcast. I'm your host, Cecilia Lynn Jacobs. For the next little while, we invite you to speculate on the possibility of life on Proxima B, the closest known planet outside of our solar system that has the potential to support life. In each episode, we question what would happen if we suddenly knew we were no longer alone in the universe, and what that would mean for humanity to become an interstellar civilization. Please, stay close.
You know, we're programmed to do this, to send people to places they're not supposed to be. It's the reason that we are where we are today, because, you know, we have moved from, you know, a small location in Africa to across the entire surface of the planet into places we were never evolved to cope in. And we learned to adapt to those conditions. You could argue it's in our DNA, or it's in our instinct to do these things. So, you know, at some point, if we have the technology, we will eventually do it. It's a question of waiting for that technology to come around.
That's Dr. Duncan Forgan of University St. Andrews. On this episode of Transmission Podcast, we consider the ethical implications of sending humans on a long-term interstellar mission.
Because humans make space exploration very expensive.
That's Ray Adams, and he works in asteroid mining. That field currently focuses on automation when it comes to piloting spacecrafts. Ray explains why we don't send or plan to send humans to asteroids anytime soon.
If you're dealing with robots, you know, you don't have to worry about life support systems. You don't have to worry about radiation shielding, or, you know, giving food and water and all this extra weight that's kind of associated with taking humans through space. That's not to say that, you know, our spacecraft can think like a human. And I think really there's no replacement for our ability to problem solve, our ability to adapt and change and, you know, fix problems as they come up to us. We try to design as much autonomy into our robotic systems as we can to replace that. But ultimately, of course, it's never going to quite be like the real thing.
The benefit of sending a human boils down to the fact that we're not very good at making artificial intelligence. We do not know how to create an intelligence with the same flexibility, problem-solving skills, and just general adaptiveness as a human.
That's Duncan Forgan at University St. Andrews. Humans simply make better decisions faster than machines, for now at least.
So as we understand that the human brain is the best computer ever evolved, and we do not know how to design a better one. And the same argument applies to going to, say, to Mars. We can certainly send lots of rovers to Mars, and the rovers can explore the environment, but they do so under human control and command. And really what we want to do is we want to send humans to that planet so that we can send effectively a geologist who can look at the landscape with their eyes and start to identify things that you just don't see in a camera. Even with a high-resolution image, being there gives humans more perspectives. It gives us a better opportunity to look for patterns, because humans are amongst the best pattern matchers out there. So all of these things are why you want to send a person.
It's important to note that when we consider sending a manned mission over such a great distance, we will effectively create an offshoot civilization.
It's not as if we can send a team and then get feedback on what they've found. It's more like we're sending an envoy, but really we basically go our separate ways, and we hope that our ancestors will be able to eventually get feedback from this other civilization that has been basically split off from us existing on Earth.
That was Dr. Joel Myers at the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics. It also begs the question, will the descendants of the first crew even want to be there? Producer Kate Ladenheim discusses this with Dr. Beth Biller.
Think about like the existential teenage angst you get if you're growing up in a small town, like a very isolated small town in the middle of nowhere. It would be like that, except in outer space. Like, I can just imagine the parent fights. Like, I didn't choose to be here. You did this to me.
You have a real serious ethical question there.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the parents, in this case, chose to leave Earth.
Mm-hmm.
the children are not given this choice. They're going into who knows what.
Unknown, potentially with extremely limited options on a one-way situation. That's a lot of emotional needs to provide for. But technically, you'd have, in addition to a crack psychotherapy team.
As Dr. Catherine Denning at York University told us, it's not a small thing to consider.
The idea of actually undertaking an interstellar voyage, that's big. The idea of leaving Earth and never coming back, that's big. The idea of leaving any world, whether that's a cultural world, a social world, a family, and never coming back, that's big. I think most of us can identify with some aspects of journeys like that. Many of us have, whether it's a small thing like going away to school, knowing that you can return, it's still big. Whether it's breaking up a family when you thought you'd be together forever, that's big. But it's just that much bigger, I think, to contemplate actually leaving the only planet that we know that we can live on and putting yourself in a tin can for an extremely long voyage to another star system. That's such a mind-boggling large thing to even contemplate.
Whoever does make the decision to send humans on a multi-generational voyage will have to think seriously about the psychological impact of the journey. Will those on board be able to cope? Dr. Aliris Allman works with an organization called 100 Year Starship, which looks at the future of interstellar travel. She researches the psychological impacts of long-term isolation. We spoke with her about how we might consider our mental survival.
Right. So a lot of this information is based on, you know, research of past studies. You do see isolation from, you know, the military and working in submarines. I mean, and then you have those studies of groups and teams in Antarctica. There's another group called High Seas. It's the Hawaiian Institute. I forget what the rest of the acronym is, but they take scientists and they basically isolate them for a year and simulate long-term, you know, long-term space travel. And what's interesting when you read what they're able to release, the first thing that these individuals talk about are their relationships. It's like, this is what, yeah, we got the task done. That was easy. That was a day-to-day thing that kept us purposeful in our work. But when the team leader has a bad day, how does that affect the team? And those are the anecdotes that really resonate and what I've used for my research. Also, looking at past studies of individuals who have done actual, you know, discussions with astronauts and looking at really, again, like you said, their journal entries and things like that that have been released, you see this ebb and flow of not only just confidence, but their relationships. One of the things I found is a lot of the research is focused on the individual and how the individual reacts with the group and not necessarily the maturity and the growth of the group as a whole. So If the three of us were to become a team, how do we grow as a team and what's the growth of our team? So if you're looking at preparing a crew to go on a mission, you're not only looking at, okay, can this person do the task? Do we have the tasks covered? Second, can this person survive the environment? You know, this is an isolating environment. Can they survive that way physiologically and psychologically as well? And then the third step is, then out of this pool of the people who, you know, passed the first two, what is the best group that we can create from that? And then Looking at that group and how that group interacts and how that group grows. And that group maturity will evolve as the mission goes on. So one of my hypotheses is that the longer the journey, the sooner that a group will have a breakdown. You know, they're dealing with uncertainty, but there will be crises along the way. And as you encounter crises and manage through them, the easier they are to manage and the less of a negative impact that crisis will have, that second, third, fourth crisis will have, because the group will have the ability to know that they can manage through it.
What are the questions we have to ask in order to be able to decide if we go? And then, how do we decide who would go?
How are people going to be forthright about psychological distress? So if I say I'm having a bad day, everyone has to understand maybe that's just a bad day. That's not saying that I don't have the ability to do my tasks. I don't have the ability to do my part. So part of one of the barriers is acknowledging that psychological distress will happen, that it's okay, and that if we can find the signs of it and address it as it happens and just give people, you know, kind of like a soft landing. And a psychological distress, it depends, just like here on Earth. We don't know how people are going to react to stress. We don't know how they're going to react to different things. One person can just start to lash out at people, yell, have a short temper, you know, and not want to talk to someone. You know, one person be very vocal. The other person say, I'm just going to go stay in my corner for the next 2 days and not talk to you. Because that's how I react to stress. And another person is going to be like, you know what? I'm going to yell at you every time because you can't do anything right. I can't do anything right. You know, and you just get this frustration. Some people can get physical. You just don't know. But I think people are very careful to manage that. It's the question is, when we get into deep space, you can manage it and have help maybe for, you know, 6 to 8 months. But when we're talking years and years and years, depending on how we design the mission and the environment that people are going to go in, it can have all kinds of different results when it comes to that impact or the way that people express that impact.
We spoke with Pippa Goldschmidt, a writer in Edinburgh who has worked on astronomy and space policy, but now writes fiction based on real science. Would you be interested in going on such a journey?
You know, some people want to be astronauts, some people want to go into outer space, and some people don't. They'd rather sort of sit here on the safety of their own Earth. I fall into the latter category. I'm such a physical scaredy cat, but at the same time, it'd be fascinating. In terms of how you organize yourself, I mean, sort of, you know, talking with my sort of like, you know, policy hat on, again, I would say that the United Nations would be the obvious way to organize and coordinate a mission, but you need the expertise of individual sort of countries and individual people. So I'm talking about this very sort of theoretically. I don't know whether I'd sort of like go and like sort of like hide under the bed or whether I'd sort of, you know, be inspired to sort of create something or both. Perhaps I'd go off and create something while simultaneously hiding under the bed. I don't know.
While there are those who will be very keen to go on the first interstellar mission, there will also be people like Pippa who prefer to be more firmly rooted here on Earth. When we return, more on the gravity of this decision. Stay close. Welcome back. In this episode of Transmission Podcast, we're talking about what it would mean to send people on an interstellar journey. Perhaps we need to use this as an opportunity to look at our own planet. Catherine Denning reminds us that there is already intelligent life right here on Earth.
And, you know, it's interesting because from the anthropological perspective, I mean, this is kind of the ultimate idea, right? You know, the notion of contact with, you know, other intelligent species from other worlds, that's kind of, you know, the absolute intellectual dream. But from my own perspective, I've also learned to focus rather differently about all the work that we kind of need to do here. Our own intelligent species that have evolved on this Earth, I'm talking about, you know, all the non-human animals that are here too, they could use a little bit more attention, or actually a lot more attention from us when we're looking at, you know, the imminent extinction of so many of them. You know, whether we're talking about various whale species, whether we're talking about elephants who are now in much more serious trouble than anybody expected them to be, whether we're talking about all our primate relatives. all of these quote-unquote aliens who we don't understand very well and who think and are sentient and are here, I think, you know, they demand our attention just as much as hypothetical aliens that may exist elsewhere. Because, you know, if you play it through, okay, so we get to, hypothetically, you know, to a planet or around another star. We meet the technological intelligence or its robot successors that sent the message to us. And that's only part of the equation. We would also be fascinated to learn all about their all their ecosystems, about all the other species that live there on that world. And it's starting to feel like, to me, like we would be a little bit more interested in their world than in our own. There's still so much to learn here and still so much to look after here. So that, for me, is, at this stage, more important.
So, for example, what's the role of human values in this? Why would people actually give up their lives on Earth to go into a spacecraft and go on a potentially perilous mission to an exoplanet with the very high likelihood that, you know, unless there was technological advances that I can't even imagine, they probably would never see the outcome?
That's Phil Searles speculating on the motivation to leave Earth behind.
Would that be altruistic, or would there be some other kinds of issues? Maybe these would be people who are scientists, and so maybe that's something where they get a deep sense of meaning if they do this. So that's one thing, you know, the human values.
Aliris Allman suggests that anyone undertaking this mission would need some pretty substantial emotional training. How vulnerable would you need to be to withstand this type of journey? Producer Kate Ladenheim joins me to discuss.
I'm struck by the extent of that training because it's really not something that we are encouraged to do culturally, at least here in America. There's definitely a lot of like a buck up sort of sort of pressure.
Well, and I think that is the challenge that, you know, as someone who studies psychology, I know it's normal for people to freak out. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, you're going to freak out. I'm going to tell you you're going to freak out. And you're going to freak out. And just give me your hand. I'm going to take you through this. Mm-hmm. And then they're fine. But there's always that initial denial. There is, you know, buck up, handle it, mm-hmm. manage it. But you can only do that for so long. And the longer the journey, you have to find a way to make it okay. And I think once an individual and a group make it through that first crisis, they're going to feel better. It's like, okay, we made it through this. We can make it through the next one. This is where we get into a lot of speculation. You know, can AI be your counselor? Artificial intelligence, is that something where you can just do that? But still, that human interaction, that one-on-one, if you get in a fight with someone or just a small argument, you want those people to be able to handle that argument in an effective manner so it doesn't fester and blow up later because you didn't address everything. It is going to take a lot of training. We're not good at it now, but, you know, we can learn and we can adapt. And when survival is at stake, people come together in amazing ways. Mm-hmm. I always kind of tease people, you know, you're one broken heart away from a disaster. The engineers would say we're one something away from the ship falling apart, or, you know, this person is one sneeze away from a heart attack or whatever. Same thing with psychology and the mind. We're one broken heart or one argument away from a disaster because you don't know at what point people are making their boiling point or hitting their boiling point. So you have to be prepared for that.
What are the kinds of practices that individuals and groups can put into place when you're on a mission and you know that you're trying to keep that stay connected to that inspiration or like to that purpose? You know, how do you continually like presence that thing that you once cared about so much, but now it's year 12 and you're really sick of Fred next door and space is still black nothing's going to change.
You know what? And in that person's lifetime, nothing may change, but what they're doing is a stepping stone to something greater. Mm-hmm. So I think you really are going to have to keep that mission top of mind and share the story. It's really about it's about storytelling and internalizing the purposefulness of your work, understanding what that work means and who finds that work important. It's obviously you and your crewmates and the people that are with you, but it's also communicating and getting support from those who aren't there as long as you can.
So, would you go? We asked Ray Adams, as someone thinking about commercial spaceflight in the near future, would you consider relocating off Earth?
In Chile, where you know I am right now, there are some regions up north in the desert where they actually test a lot of the Mars rovers. It just happens to be an area that's very similar in the composition of the dirt and the level of dryness and the wind and everything else. And I had a similar thought too while I was up there visiting and standing there, and I was like, I don't know if I would want this for the rest of my life, right? If it was a one-way ticket, do I really want to be in such a dry location in a spacesuit and in a very small environment? And, you know, part of you is like, well, no, I wouldn't be very comfortable, but certainly the chance of something like that is just too great to pass up. Especially, you know, I'm personally just hooked on this concept of exploration and of course want to go to space at some point. A distance that far, I haven't really thought of.
Catherine Denning spoke with us about this idea of leaving Earth permanently and whether or not we are programmed to say goodbye to our homes.
If we're talking about leaving Earth and never coming back, that plays into kind of two big stories of our age. One is the story of displacement. There are more people on this Earth displaced than ever before, and that's partly just a function of global population, but also just what's happening in the world. It's extraordinary how many people have had to make the choice to leave the only home they've ever known and move on. And I think that creates a certain psychology in the world where it becomes that much more thinkable to just leave on a bigger scale. And I think it also plays into the notion of escape. There's enough wrong in the world today, enough really big stuff that nobody can see easily how to fix, that there is, I think, a real impulse to get off this rock and go and try for, quote unquote, an Earth 2.0, which is phrasing that I personally have a big problem with because I think it erodes our commitment to this Earth. But I can understand both the multiplanetary mandate, the idea that we need to distribute humanity's presence throughout the galaxy, one little bit at a time, obviously, starting with the solar system and then going beyond. So I can understand that. But at the same time, I think there's something very troubling there because I think many people, if they had a choice, they would choose not to be displaced. And if they had a choice, they would choose not to have to escape. And yet that is where so many of us find ourselves in those kinds of situations where there is not much here that we have a deep commitment to that we can't maintain in our hearts and minds while we went on a much larger journey. So in the initial stages of an interstellar voyage, you'd have some degree of communication. And then, of course, it would just stop and you would have to say goodbye to all your loved ones, just as you eventually do when they die anyway. But in terms of the whole world that you're leaving behind, I think that's something that people are perhaps more ready to do than they've ever done, than we've ever been before. And that, to me, is actually one of the tragedies of our age, that displacement has reached such epic proportions that we can think of leaving this planet, which is, for all its flaws, still such a beautiful world, that we can think quite cheerfully about leaving it behind and going into the void to a destination that you might never reach to encounter a species that might not be nice. That's really saying something about how eroded our attachment to this place, to this reality, to this here and now has become. So to me, that's kind of the underside to this story.
Every time we disconnect from a place, it has a profound effect on us. Now, only 5% of the world is indigenous. This small percentage of people are the only ones that are still living on the parts of our planet tied to their ancestral origins. 95% of the world's population has a shared history of displacement. And beyond that, moving around is a big part of our lives. Did you go away for school? Move for a job? Are you a refugee fleeing conflict and trying to provide a new life for your children out of harm's way? Our human story is so defined by disconnecting from a place. Are we, in some sense, programmed to leave our homes behind? Would you decide to go? Let us know online at luxdeterra.com and on Twitter and Facebook at luxdeterra. This has been Transmission Podcast, hosted by Cecilia Lynn Jacobs and produced by Ian Garrett and Kate Ladenheim. With special thanks to today's guests,
Pippa Goldschmitz,
Beth Diller,
Dr. Duncan Forgan,
Catherine Denning,
Phil Thurls,
Joel Myers,
Ray Adams,
Aliris Ullman.
Original composition and sound editing by Miles Avery. Transmission is a podcast and performance series speculating on what might happen if we began to receive the popular broadcasts of intelligent alien life, and follows two sisters selected to lead an interstellar mission to make first contact. Learn more about our team and upcoming performances at luxdeterra.com and find us on Facebook and Twitter at luxdeterra. That's LuxTaTerra. Transmission is a production of Toaster Lab in Canada and is a fiscally sponsored project of Fractured Atlas in the United States.